CliffCentral.com.
Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, young and old, him and her, and everybody else that just wants to use other pronouns. I am Simpiwe Zamagile Mthethwa, and with me is Ryan James Tinline and Matt. And no, Gareth is not here, guys. We've decided to take over the studio, and we've kind of just been like, to the left, everything you own in a box, to the left, in the closet, that's my stuff, yes, if I bought it. Please don't rush. There you guys go. Yeah, I'll send my invoice to you guys, and you can pay me for that young performance. I'm a 17 tau. Mash, how you doing?
I am feeling good. Coming to the studio this morning was a bit of a slip because Rivonia Road is closed, which is something that's very odd because I've never seen such before. I mean, it's the road that connects most of Sandton together. So that was a bit of an odd one.
Do you know why it could have been closed? Like, is there...
I don't know. There's been a lot of work on the roads lately. Whether they're fixing the traffic lights... I'm not the traffic lights. The actual lights. The street lights. Because some of these street lights are just exploding. Because power is always coming in and out, just like our appliances back at home. So they just have to replace them every now and then. So I am just glad I made it. That is what matters most. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have some fun.
All right. That's awesome. I do want to just talk about Third Draft podcast. We do have a new podcast that's going to play out today at 10 a.m. on cliffcentral.com. And this week, I'm super excited about the guest that we get to talk to. She is an incredible young lady who's doing amazing things. She was selected to be part of the YouTube Black Voices funding and also the Spotify funding. So, you know, the girl's making some money, some ching, 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 ching. She has a YouTube channel and she also has her own podcast. It's called her YouTube channel, Uncomfortable Growth. Her podcast is After School with Google. And you can, you know, listen to that podcast of Third Draft today at 10 a.m. with our guest, Ukuguletu. All right.
Or wherever you get your podcast.
I didn't encode that one.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. I enjoy all the guests that we have, the creatives that we get to speak to and just engage with. Like, it's super dope. It's super amazing. I wanted us to talk about familiar sounds, you know. I don't know, like, do you guys have, like, any particular sounds that, you know, the minute you hear it, it takes you back to Kumbulekaya moments or, like, childhood moments or, like, where you're like, oh, my God. Like one of whatever's time, you know.
Yes. For me, it's mostly just the sound of screaming, and yeah, you know, people getting spanked. That's about it for me. I mean, my childhood was pretty, you know, hectic. Yes, quite indeed.
So man, wait, Ryan, for you. Oh
my! I was gonna say, you know, the starting sound of a PlayStation 2 is something I haven't heard in a while, but it brings back some good memories.
Yeah.
You know?
Is that the Nokia 3310, right? That's, I'm right with that sound. Yeah, like that one. Yo, guys, yeah, like it's engraved in me. It's engraved. Like it's engraved.
I'm sure there's still a Nokia 3310 out there that's still on. Because the battery's so good.
Yes. Oh, they don't make the phones the way they used to make it. No. You know, your phone will last up to 3 weeks before it dies. Now your phone lasts 2 minutes and it's tickets. Absolute tickets.
There is a sound that is quite...
No, see, Steve is in the comments and he says, remember first dial-up modems. I don't know if you guys ever... Yeah. Yes. And you couldn't use the phone, remember? Like if you took it off the hook, then it would interrupt your interrupt your connection.
That doo-doo-doo sound is absolutely iconic. Absolutely iconic. And I remember actually I actually kept using a bit of dial up until I think 2010. So I was on that tip for quite some time. With the 3G modems as well. You still had to dial them up, the older 3G modems, before they even had software.
Really?
Yes, I was busy dialing up modems when I ran.
Oh, it didn't make a sound though, right? It was just one of those programs you had to kind of launch it, if I remember correctly.
Yes, you just had to launch it. But there is another sound that is quite iconic. It's a production company sound. I can't remember the production company's name. It has been trending on TikTok quite a bit as well. And it goes like, I have to just make the sound with my mouth because I can't remember the name of the production company. But
go ahead, Mash. Take it away.
So it just goes like, and then it just keeps it up. And it, the volume gets really high. It was actually quite prominent in the cassette days. Whenever you got a cassette and you'd put it in there, maybe an action movie or something, this sound would start playing. I can't remember for the life of me the name of the production company, but they became synonymous with that sound. It's quite legendary.
Oh, wow. The one sound that also came to mind is the Jaws soundtrack. Like, I can't make it now. Dun, dun.
Dun, dun. Is it that one?
I think so. I just thought of Jaws. Like, it was so dramatic. And, we also have one saying, what about playing Bounce on the Nokia? That game. Game was on level 3050. Like, it was so hard to just make it to the next level. I remember that game. Mm-hmm. Tracy over here says Snakes and Ladders. No, playing Snakes on the old Nokias, man, oh man, we were impressed by it very little. Yeah, I think that's also one of the best games that were ever dropped. Snakes, come on now.
Did you guys do the Bluetooth one? There was, if you had two Nokias, you could connect via either Bluetooth or infrared. It was infrared at first, and then you could have two snakes going together. Right. I don't know if you remember that.
Ken, what were you playing?
Yeah, I feel like I missed out.
Yeah. My cousin and I would get my dad's phone and my cousin would get her dad's phone.
That sounds...
We would play, we'd connect via infrared before Bluetooth was a thing. And then you could have the two snakes. Did no one else do that? Is that not a thing?
What were you buying these?
Bluetooth.
It's a normal Nokia.
What Nokia? We had normal Nokias and they couldn't do that.
It wasn't a 3310, I'll tell you that.
You're going to hate this. Baby Shark. Baby Shark. Baby Shark. Baby Shark. Baby Shark. Baby.
I'm always with my little cousins and my little nieces and babysitting them all the time. For me, it is just fun. And also, I just got the name of the company that made that iconic sound, Lucasfilm THX.
Oh, okay.
When you see this artwork, you should know this.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about now. No, I know. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I can't describe it either. You kind of need to have it.
It gets really loud. Your house will start shaking. That's when you knew I'm about to watch a good movie.
Okay. Well, Ryan, you're not the only one who's with this Bluetooth connection. It was real, you know. Mash and I might have not, you know, experienced it, but people in the comments are busy saying that no, it was a real thing. It was a very, very real thing. Yeah. So I do have like a quick question for y'all before we get into one of Gareth's guest interviews. Have you guys started like planning 2023 yet? In terms of like, do you guys believe in vision boards? Do you guys believe in writing down your plans and starting to like be like, what did I achieve and start doing reflection on the year of 2022?
Yes, you have to. You absolutely have to. I believe that this is something that everybody should be doing. It's something that I've been doing since around matric.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like matric actually prepares you for that, for planning ahead. Because, I mean, in matric, you're not just sitting there just saying, you know what, whatever the world throws at me, I'm going to go with. You're already planning your life ahead. You're applying for varsities from mid-September, sometimes early August.
Mm-hmm.
So since matric, it is a tradition or a habit that I got into pretty early. And even now, I was actually sharing some plans of mine with you guys just yesterday as well. That, you know what, I was telling Gareth, for example, that my goal for OF is to get to $3,000 dollars OF.
Yes.
And I shared some plans with you guys as well in the office. that, listen, next year, 7, 8, 10 must happen. If it doesn't happen, then I'm forcing it to happen as well. So I believe that life is about the planning and planning a year ahead or even a few months ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So are you guys on that tip as well? Are you guys planning for 2023 already?
So I am. I'm really starting to look at what do I want to achieve next year. But the reason why I asked this question is that there's always this list of things that must stay behind in 2020 or the previous years. And I'm always like shocked at when I start seeing these lists come out. Like, yes, we start planning for the future, but also people are like, please stop, please calling me, you know? And that's what I'm also curious to know. What are some of the things you guys feel like must just stay in 2022? Don't follow me. Don't enter the new year with me or the country, per se, right? Do you want to start?
Yo, I was going to say fuel prices, but I'm feeling that's
yeah.
Must just go down. Must just go.
I couldn't believe it. Like, diesel's 5 rand more than petrol the other day. I was like, how did we get here? Because there was a time when it was a competing market. Now it's just completely out the gate. Personally though, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Probably long meetings. We can leave like long online meetings.
Mm.
You know.
Yes.
Absolutely. Or meetings that you have nothing to do with. Where
exactly.
They invite like half the people in the office and it's like, well, why am I here? I have absolutely nothing to do with this. That we can leave. Can we also leave?
We can leave.
Leave what?
Can we also leave people?
People. Leave. Abantu.
Yeah.
But.
I mean.
Yeah, we can leave people.
Sure.
In this year. Yeah.
Okay.
We just, you know, cut, you know.
Okay.
Oh, are you one of those who like rounds it up and
I
like,
am not.
Actually.
You know those people who go like, after midnight, if you no longer see my WhatsApp statuses. You're no longer my friend. And it's something that a lot of my contacts are quite big on. And fortunately enough, none of them have disappeared. They never do. But a lot of people, it's that time of the year, you see people saying, yeah, time to cut off the fat. Time to stop talking to people who don't serve you. Yeah, new year, yeah. New friends. It's that time of the year.
No. Like, people need to stop with those cryptic messages. Like, stop it. Nobody cares. No one gets it. Like, just stop with the whole, like, one thing that I've learned about 2022 is that you can never trust anybody. So if you don't see my WhatsApp statuses, just know that I've cut you off. We don't care. Cut off, block, I'm dare say. We don't care. Just keep on moving, chief.
Absolutely.
So that's one of the things. Please stop with the cryptic, WhatsApp statuses. Also, Bazalwane, right? I feel like if you're going to put me on your close friends, if you're not spilling some tea, don't put me on your close friends on Instagram.
Absolutely.
Like, stop that, right? The close friends is either you posting something very explicit or you cheating, dog. Or you tell, yeah, let me quickly tell you about. So one of my followers, one of the people I follow, sorry, on Instagram, she's constantly putting the green circle. And she has a man, y'all. She has a boyfriend. But she's constantly sharing stories about her work husband and how they be flirting and how they, like, you know, like, this week he bought me lunch and it was the year-end function and did they not get a bit too cozy and they were bamba-bambing. I'm like, that's the kind of tea I want to see on close friends. You know, where I'm like, I'm holding a secret in. If it's not juicy, leave me out of it.
Yes.
Okay? Okay.
No, that I fully agree with that, Simpiwe. I do believe that whenever I open a close friends, I'm expecting to see titties or ass or some sort of secret that you've been hiding. You know, that's what I'm expecting to see when I open only friends.
It's okay, Mash. We're not gonna judge you. It's okay. Do share with us what are some of the things that you feel like must stay in 2022. We must not, you know, enter in 2023 with those things, like, you know. Corruption, if corruption could fall, that'd be great. That'd be amazing. That'd be all that in a bag of chips. Cheating, if that could also just fall, like, it would be so nice. It could be girls.
I know some people want us to leave our president in 2022 as well.
Oh, cupcake. Yeah, he can stay. Well, the ANC as a whole can just...
Yeah, when I think of Didi Mabuza, I'm like, hey, you know what, let's just keep cupcake. It's fine.
Oh, man. Thank you guys for like listening to us, spending some time with us this morning. I know, the big G was not in the building, but as you can see, we were holding the fort. We're doing the things to be done. And before we wrap it up, we live in a world of distractions. Does one need to follow a specific approach to find inner peace, or can one access it by adapting a way of being that might contribute to improved emotional health? Could mindfulness be that way? On this week's edition of Beyond Madness, we look at mindfulness and self-awareness. In proud association with Adcock Ingram, OTC, sponsors of Break, listen wherever you get your podcasts. So definitely give that episode a listen. Mindfulness, ooh, you know, and talking of being mindfulness and the big G in the building, we're going to play an interview that he had with Iris Singer, who is an Australian filmmaker and activist who has been telling the story of the Holocaust and survivors of the Holocaust. This interview, you can get it on YouTube, also on podcast after the show or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Mash, you are great. Ryan, you are awesome. Let's go out there, do some work. And we'll be back, you know, and hopefully, you know, the big G will be back, you know, he'll be back.
Well, there is an amazing award-winning exhibition that has just opened in Johannesburg at the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center, and it will travel also to Durban and Cape Town over the coming year. It's called Seeing Auschwitz, and it was developed by one of the world's leading experts on the Holocaust. It is currently on in Johannesburg, and will be free to attend. It presents more than 100 scarce images of victims and perpetrators, as well as a visual and audio testimony of survivors. It's open until the end of March 2023. You can go along and see it at the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center. Now, today, I'm really, really pleased to be able to welcome someone who is an incredible film producer and presenter. Since 2015, she's been the co-director of the organization March of Remembrance and Hope in Austria with a film production company, which is called Licht und Linsen. She has been producing films, including Facing Auschwitz in 2020, in which four young people are accompanied on the journey to Auschwitz. In 2021, she launched the project Raise Your Voice, in which young people were called upon to write short stories on the subject of civil courage, five of which were selected and filmed. Incredible, incredible stuff. It is a great pleasure to welcome Iris Singer. How are you, Iris?
Hi, thank you. I'm fine. It's just a great pleasure for the invitation to be here today. So thank you very much.
Congratulations on your work. It's no secret that, you know, South Africa is far off the beaten track for much of this. And I'm delighted that we could have this exhibition here. Of course, it is and should remain a preoccupation of humanity that we remember the stories of when we have done less than what is honorable to each other as human beings. And the Holocaust remains this real blight on the story of humanity in the 20th century. It's obviously something, though, which leads people like you to so many incredible stories. And I just want to start off with your own family and how that got you to the position where you're now talking about filming, producing, presenting information about all of this. Tell us about your own family background. And you're in Austria, which of course is also the birthplace of not so many good things.
Exactly. So, you know, to be born in Austria, looking back to Austrian history, what has happened, growing up in a very loving and very caring family. But of course, still, you know, my parents are born in 1939 and 1940. So my grandparents will survive the Second World War, and they have their history. So in my family, you know, they always talked about your step-grandfather. He got in, he was fighting in Second World War. And when he came back and he was suffering, you know, so hungry and so on. But what also was happening were this anti-Semitic comments from my granddad that just like happened once a week. We had once a week, the whole family was meeting at my grandparents' house. This was a really tradition. The whole family was getting together, my brother, my sister, my parents, my grandparents and me. And, you know, during the conversation, when it came up to politics or when it came up, also talking about money, my grandfather out of the seven started saying this anti-Semitic comments. So what was the reaction in our family? My father was like, "Father, please stop that. We don't want anything like that here." My brother, who's older than me, he was like behaving like, "This is bad, but okay. He's an old man, you know, let him talk a bit." And for me, I just remember this since I was 7 or 8 years old. It was always not even understanding 100% what happened in the Second World War, but just understanding that this is not okay. So I just, you know, threw the cutlery on the table, got up, locked myself in the toilet, cried, came back after five minutes, and lunch continued. And this is how, you know, I remember the childhood. The older I got, the more I started, well, argumenting, but also asking my grandfather questions. I also have to say about my grandfather, or step-grandfather, it's my stepfather of my father. My aunt, my dad's sister, was married to a Jewish artist, and my grandfather really liked him, you know, as a person, as an artist. So he was really, really, so I never understood, you know, on one hand, you can really like somebody and say like, it's a great person, he's a great guy. And then 5 minutes later, you say this anti-Semitic comments. You think like, what's happening in your brain? And my grandfather, he was a doctor, a very, very caretaking doctor in the place where he lived. And when we were, you know, because I asked him about, did you know about Auschwitz? Did you know what happened there? And, you know, then he got quite quiet and he said like, yeah, terrible what happened there. It's really terrible. And then he said like, you know, as a doctor, I have to help people. It doesn't matter who they are, which nationality, which religion they have. You just need to help. So, you know, the older he got, the more you keep on asking questions, but I could never understand how is this manageable in one brain. On the one hand, you're saying that. On the other hand, you're saying this completely brainwashed, terrible, you know, anti-Semitic comments.
Yeah, there are two things I want to pick up on here because this is really interesting. And first of all, to just find someone who's from either Germany or Austria who even grew up in a family where they talked about this stuff is quite something. Yeah. Because a lot of Germans and Austrians that I know, and I've, of course, that's not a sample by any means, but we have a large German population of South Africans, you know, that come from Germany or speak German or consider themselves, you know, they go to Deutsche Schule or they play at the German sports club and they learn German in their schools as a first or second language. And often Germans that I have met who are from Germany are just terrified to even talk about the war. They're terrified to even talk about anything to do with the Nazis. They anytime the Holocaust comes up, they almost get this fear in their eyes because I suppose they think that they're being held personally responsible for this. But there's a huge discomfort. And I'm just worried because of all the laws and the rules that were made up after World War II and the fact that so many Germans have had to just almost expunge that from their history. It's a lot like the Afrikaans people in South Africa when it comes to apartheid. I'm just worried that these things, when they are left in the dark and they're not seen to and people don't talk about them like your family did, even if it was uncomfortable, that they somehow become worse. So I'd like to have your thoughts on that one. And then I also want to pick your brain about this idea that you just raised of, you know, your step-grandfather who said, "Oh no, I like that Jew, but the Jews I have a problem with." Mm-hmm. You know, we'll get to that in a second, but maybe first the attitude of Germany and Austria post-World War II, long before you and I were born, but something which I think, you know, they've struggled with.
I mean, of course, it's not a very like nice part of history looking back to that. And even, you know, my mother was born in 1940, so she was a child. Even for her, it's difficult. And she keeps on saying it was so terrible. But, you know, we didn't know it. I didn't know it. I couldn't do anything. So you can feel there's this feeling of guilt what I think is so impossible. It's, you know, today it's not about, or for me, it's not about talking about guilt. It's talking about responsibility and what can we learn out of history and how can we change the present and the future. So what I'm doing, you just sent it when you in the introduction, I'm co-director of the organization March of Remembrance and Hope. And we are exactly focusing on that. So focusing on history and on, like, don't forget what happened. Talk about it and learn out of it. So what we are doing is we are organizing once a year a three-day memorial trip for Austrian, mostly non-Jewish pupils to Auschwitz to take part at the March of the Living. The March of the Living is an international memorial march from Auschwitz I to Birkenau, in which between, I don't know, 15 and 20,000 people from all over the world come there. It's survivors, the children of survivors, the grandchildren of survivors. And they come there to set a sign together and to say, and never again, this can never happen again. And I think this is also a way, because, you know, the other part is survivors, they are now really, really old. So in a few years, we're not going to have the survivors telling their personal stories and telling what happened to them. And just like we said before, it's not them, the Jews. Here you can hear the, like, certain personal stories, what happened to a woman, a man, giving them a name, an age, feelings. So this is so important. Yeah, so I think just to keep that up, keep on talking about it, because when you look what's happening right now in the world, how much terrible things are going on. And it's the same mechanisms that led to the Shoah are the same that are still going on today. There's still a lot of fake news. There's still a we and them. And I think we need to stop that.
You know, so, you're so right. And anti-Semitism seems to me to be a, almost a different kettle of fish to other kinds of prejudice. You know, it's the original one. It's the one that stretches the furthest back in history. And it seems to be a kind of hatred that isn't based on anything flippant and silly. It's based on, like, the basic integrity of a human being. I mean, you don't have to be religious to be the victim of anti-Semitism. You don't have to be very proudly Jewish in terms of your ancestry or your cultural heritage. You don't have to look a certain way or sound a certain way. Anti-Semitism really hates someone for who they are at their deepest level. And I think that that's something which humans are still struggling to deal with. It's been around for thousands of years. Hopefully we managed to find a way to stop it. And if the Holocaust wasn't the best reason for us to change our behavior with respect to anti-Semitism, I don't know what is. But it's amazing that you're doing these trips. What kind of response do you get from the young kids when you take these students to Auschwitz, when you show them for the first time what actually happened? Because so few people on earth have been there. Obviously, they're very, you know, important places, and there are lots of people that do go there on a daily basis. But more of us need to see what actually happened to know that it was real, that it occurred. I mean, there are still Holocaust deniers, and, you know, like the Ayatollah of Iran and the president of Iran not so long ago were denying the Holocaust. And there are still people who say, oh, you know, it was never that many people or whatever. Outrageous things. And then when you go there, you see it for yourself, and it can be really moving. Obviously deeply, deeply sad. But when you're accompanied by actual survivors, it must be very powerful.
I think this is also one of the main parts of March of Remembrance and Hope, what we're doing. We're having every year a survivor with us. So on this three-day trip, you're not only visiting Museum Auschwitz and getting a guided tour there. You're not only participating at the March of the Living together with 15,000 other people. You also have the chance to meet a survivor and to talk to him, or this year it's going to be a her. So I think this makes a big change. And what we get back as a feedback, because, you know, we're like a March of Remembrance and Hope. We started in 2007. So my first year was in 2008. Since 2015, I'm like co-director of the organization. And what we're getting back as a feedback from our team, but also from the students, from the pupils, you know, they are between 16, 17, 18 years old. And, one of the teachers we know quite well, she told us, like, she had a conversation with some of the parents, and the parents said, you know what? My child changed. It got grown up a bit more since that trip, because it changes something in your mindset. It changes, you know, they see the world differently. And for me, as organizing the whole journey or the whole project, of course, it's a fantastic feedback when you suddenly see, great, you know, they take something with them. It really changes them. And one of the, like, really nice stories, I'd love to tell if that's okay. We had, so we were doing in 2019, 2020, I was with my film company producing the film Facing Auschwitz. So we had three girls and one boy, four pupils, students we accompanied on the journey, on the Morat journey. And, you know, the whole project was, we had problems with financing, and my team and I, we just said, like, okay, it doesn't matter what, we really want to do that, because this is so important to show in a very personal way what is happening with the students during those days. You know, what are their feelings before going there, their worries. Yeah. Like, the film starts with one of the girls saying, tomorrow the journey is going to start and I'm not ready and I'm scared. And this is how it starts. And then, you know, the different steps they are going through, what they are seeing, their, you know, when they're listening to the survivor, their thoughts, and also afterwards. And what turned out afterwards is, so the film project was over, the Morat trip to Poland was over. And what we're always doing is, after the project is finished, like 5 to 6 weeks later, we're doing a closing event in Vienna. So all the pupils, and we are in total between 800 and 1,000 pupils that are coming with us to March of Remembrance and Hope. So we invite all of them to, like, a closing event in Vienna. And about a week before our closing event, there was in Vienna the exhibition Lest We Forget. That was an exhibition showing about 400 survivor portraits. The photographer and I think also filmmaker Luigi Toscano made that. And this exhibition has been traveling all over the world. So it's been in Ukraine, it's been in Germany, it's been in the US, in Washington, so on. You know, all over the world, and it's an outdoor exhibition. So the portraits are about 1.5 meter high. And, you know, everywhere around the world, nothing happened. Everything went well. Then the exhibition came 2019 to Vienna, and the portraits were on Burgring, which is quite a nice big street in Vienna. So what happened after a few days is somebody cut the pictures and wrote anti-Semitic or National Socialism comments on them. And, you know, that was shocking for everybody, because how can you do that? There were survivors that were still alive, that were there, that had to see that. So what happened, many people showed civil courage. They stayed there overnight. They sued the pictures, like, make them look nice again. And what happened with our film students, or, Facing Auschwitz kids, is I sent them a link of the article, what happened. And like, one day later, one of them gave me a call and just said, like, you know, it's so terrible what happened there. And she can't believe it, that this happened in Vienna and that somebody could do something like that. And she said, like, you know what? I would like to do something, because I can't let that stand like that. I really want to become active. And I told her, you know, I'm going to support you. Whatever you want to do, you're getting my fully support. So what she did, or what the four of them did at our closing event, they called everybody, all few hundred pupils that were at our closing events. They called them to walk to the street, to Burgring, to walk to the portraits. And there they had a box with 111 red hearts. And then they said, like, we've got the red hearts here. Everybody can just write a message on a heart and just put it next to them or put it on the fence behind them and just like set a sign of respect and love and not letting this, you know, damaged portraits be there, just showing, hey, we are here, we care, and we want to set a sign. And that is working out. And the kids just said, like, before the journey, they wouldn't have become active. But after right. that, they just can't let that stand like that. They need to do something. And it's a small thing, but, you know, a big output.
Yeah, I often look at, and maybe it's because I'm, you know, into my 40s now, and I also used to be a wide-eyed student with big ideas of how I was going to change the world. And I see a lot of people in Gen Z and even millennials now who are desperately looking for something to rally behind. And too often the internet provides us with the most lazy option. You know, you can go online and you can have a fight with someone on Twitter, or you can go and change your profile picture and put a flag on it or a badge or whatever else. And it kind of gets you the cheap points that you need so that you look like a good person. But I wonder sometimes, because I'm also a student of history and I love hearing the stories of our past, trying to make sense of them, trying to see where people went in incredible directions and took civilization forward, and where they did ridiculous and horrible and stupid and absolutely ghastly things like the Holocaust. But I wonder how many kids, until they've been on a trip like you took these ones on, actually understand how much of history is not just a story. You know, it's not a Marvel comic movie. It's not some kind of short story that is over and done in an hour on YouTube. These are real lives, millions and millions of people who went to their deaths unnecessarily and at the hands of a particularly cruel regime of people. And that those people could very easily be you and me. You know, people like to think, well, if I were in Nazi Germany back in the 1930s, I would have stood up for this. No, you wouldn't. Most people lack courage. They really don't have the kind of courage that you're talking about when you talk about these survivors, when you talk about the kind of people who managed to fight these regimes and free the people in those concentration camps, let alone the people in Germany and Austria. And I just wonder how much of it is cheap kind of signaling sometimes from them, unless they actually go to the trouble of getting involved in something like you have. What do you think it was that made you a film producer, an activist, someone who's genuinely making a difference every day, as opposed to one of these people who just says the right thing on social media? And does it irritate you like it does me?
It irritates a lot, because, you know, it makes it just like you said, or like you just described it, it can be so easy. You change your profile picture and then you got the feeling, great, I've done something, I've set a sign. But I think that it's not, I think many people, they want to become more active. You just maybe, I don't know, show them different ways what they can do. Because being active or showing civil courage is not always a big, big thing. You know, you can, like I said before, with the project of the 111 hearts, so small things, not with a lot of effort. You can just do really small things, but I think you just need to do it and don't look away. And when I say about don't looking away, this is also a story that touches my heart a lot again and again, because it was a very special person. We had Morat, we had for almost 10 years a survivor with us, Mr. Marco Feingold. And Mr. Feingold died with incredibly 106 years. So wow. He came with us at the Morat journey till he was 105. And that was sort of, you know, a main event when he was talking to our students. And Mr. Feingold was one of the most, you know, for the organization, for the pupils, but I also need to say for me personally, one of the most charming, inspiring and incredible persons I've ever had the privilege to meet. And, you know, we always did. So he did his speech and then afterwards he was answering questions from the students. Mm-hmm. And every year there was the question, so what's your message to the youth? So what shall we do? How can we make a change? Shall we become more active? what can we do? So this, like the Shoah, is never going to happen again. And his answer was always the same. He looked at them and he just said, like, be aware. Don't look away and don't believe everything that somebody tells you. So just keep on asking questions. Is that possible? Could that be? And, you know, be aware and be active. And this is what also I'm trying to, like, working a lot with young people to transport. Everybody has his or her own, you know, things to do, work, school, university, private life. We're always busy, busy, busy. But I mean, come on, this is our world and this is our future. And I think, like, for us, for our families, for our friends, I want to live in a world with respect and humanity. So, and you think, like, if everybody just looks away, then we're having a really problem. So don't look away. And this also starts, for example, I don't know, when you're somewhere sitting in the bus or sitting in the train and hearing a racist or anti-Semitic comment of somebody or somebody who's just, like, you know, not behaving nicely, don't look away. Stand up in a polite way and say, like, excuse me, I don't think this is correct what you're saying. You know, it doesn't always have to be like, I don't know, the James Bond mission fighting, whatever. Small, small things, even a smile can make a change to somebody.
Yeah, and maybe we also need to be exactly what Mr. Feingold said. We have to be aware and we have to also know that sometimes when large groups of people behave in a certain way and the government tries to sell you a story about things and there's propaganda involved, which is a big part of what happened in Germany in the 1930s.
Yes.
You know, when it's, there's one narrative and that it dominates just too much and it seems to be okay to other a certain group of people, you know, and that other could change. It was the Jews in 1939. Yeah. It was every other kind of person going back in history. At certain points, everyone has had prejudice against them, even if it's in, you know, in families. People at families are like, you know, don't talk to aunt whoever. She's mad. She's crazy. Whatever the case may be, that's at a very micro level. But we're often lied to and we're told propagandistic stories. And I think for many people, they want to believe or they don't want to believe certain things. And what Mr. Feingold, who you told us about, seems to be saying is figure it out for yourself. Don't just accept what everyone else says, whether they say they're good or bad. Actually do a bit of investigation yourself, because you may discover along the way that the people, and I think it was Jonathan Haidt, the professor at NYU, who said in a recent interview I listened to, that the people who tell you how good they are and seem to be all wholesome and fantastic are very often the ones who commit the most horrible atrocities in their personal lives. You know, they cheat on their wives, they steal from other people, they do damage to property. They are nasty to dogs and to children and all kinds of things, but they present themselves as being these wonderful people. And you really have to be a little bit cynical about humanity, because as much as there is good and people like me and you, I suppose we want to believe in the best in people, but there are genuinely awful people out there who will try to put on a front that they're wonderful and that they do the right thing and that they can be trusted and all of that stuff. And then we elect them to government and they become monsters. So I think that's really important what he said there.
It is really, you know, especially I think, you know, these words, I can also tell the students these words, but it really made a difference if a Shoah survivor who survived four different concentration camps, one of them was Auschwitz, standing in Birkenau, that's where we're doing our survivor talk, standing in Birkenau, you know, and giving them those message. And then you think, like, well, okay, it's a little change. At least I can, you know, transport this message, or he can transport this message to 800 or 1,000 Austrian students, and hopefully they will pass this message on and they will remember it, what this 105-year-old man has told them when they asked, so what's it? Well, how can we make a change?
How amazing that you got to have him for 105 years. I mean, you know, you got to have him for a large percentage of his life right at the end. And so many people in their 90s and hundreds can't give back you know, they're too old or they're too feeble. For this man to have been able to do that at 105 is absolutely exceptional. So tell me, what did you think of the exhibition when you were in South Africa?
It was absolutely fantastic. First, I need to say it was such a big honor from the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center that they invited me to come to open the exhibition, to come as a keynote speaker. And walking through the exhibition, it was so, you know, I got goosebumps. It was touching, scary, emotional, everything at the same moment. And even if the pictures are like, what do you say? Like, it's hard to look at them, but at the same moment, it's so important not to look away, to look at them and to have a look. Okay, this has really happened in the past. And I think also, I mean, of course, it's always one thing is what you learn out of books, you learn in school, you learn in your history lessons. But I think, like, especially going to such an exhibition, getting some more background information. We had at the opening, there were even a few survivors there that had also a look at the exhibition. This makes a completely different, you know, atmosphere. Just when you also, when you know, okay, even survivors came here and they had a look at it. And so I think it's really important. It was very inspiring, very well done exhibition. And I can just recommend it to everybody. It's really worth it going there and seeing and learning and taking something with you. You can take a lot out of it, taking with you out there.
Well, you also said there are not going to be very many survivors left soon because they're all getting very old. And there's something that happens with history when it passes into secondhand history, and it's no longer the firsthand stories of those who were actually there at the time. Yeah. Obviously, what you're doing is part of what will keep that alive. And that's very powerful and very moving, quite apart from the fact that it's important that these stories be told in order to make sure that nothing like this happens. Again, it's also a documentation of history. And we're lucky to live at a time, Iris, I'm sure you'll agree, where we have the equipment and the ability to be able to record these things. And it doesn't have to cost thousands and thousands of euros or rands or anything else. And we're able to keep a time capsule, really, of these amazing people. You must have been very moved meeting people like Mr. Feingold. Are there any other stories that have really stood out for you and very moving ideas that have come from some of the people you've interviewed and spoken to?
Well, of meeting quite a few survivors, it's, you know, it's always incredible. Like those survivors I met, and we had a panel discussion, and I had the big honor to be the presenter of this panel discussion 2 weeks ago. Like it's always the thing, how positive and how active they are. And they keep on saying like, yes, because seeing young people that are interested, sometimes they can't even believe like, so many people are here just to listen to me. And, but it gives them so much power. This is also what Mr. Feingold said, like, the young people give me the power. Michael Feingold kept on saying like, you know what? I can't die yet. I can't go because I need to tell my story to even more young people and more and more and more. So I think this is what really, you know, you have, yeah, you have a message and you have something to do. So I think that's what really keeps them alive. I just met a very, very nice survivor at the panel discussion. And it was this wonderful, I think like 95 or 96 year old lady. And, you know, we're having Corona. It was cold, but she came to this panel discussion and it was so important to her, you know, to talk and to tell her story. She was in Theresienstadt. Her father was in Auschwitz, but she was such a wonderful and shining person and such a loving spirit. And also she said like about the question, what's the message? She also said like, come on, keep on reading newspapers, the right newspapers and ask the right questions, you know, and just be aware. So yeah. I think this is what always comes back, or it's always the message of the survivors. What I also need to tell, I've like most stories to tell, of course, of Mr. Feingold, because I knew him for a very long time. But what is also quite inspiring, you know, the March of the Living is about 2 to 3 kilometers from Auschwitz I to Birkenau. So you walked that. So till Marco Feingold was 100 years old, he walked that. So he had his walking sticks. He did the walking. Then he entered Birkenau. Then it's another about a kilometer walking at the back. Then he talked for 2 hours to our students. Then he walked back to the main entrance. Then for another 1.5 hours with the students in the bus, you know, answering questions, doing. And then he got to the hotel. And even when he had dinner, there were again students around him. And every time you had the feeling when there was nobody around, you could see now he's tired. The moment he felt somebody is around him, you know, his body was from this to that and saying like, keep on asking questions. And I think this is also about it. The survivors, it's different. You know, there are some that don't want to talk, which is okay, because these people have been through really a lot and not everybody wants to talk. I also had one survivor. He was a child, so he got hidden in Amsterdam by a family when his parents got deported. And he just is now 83 or 84. And he just started talking a few years ago, because he said, like, you know, it's hard for him to remember. He just found out a few years ago what really happened with his parents. You know, they died in Auschwitz. And he didn't know for a very long time what happened to them. And just, you know, by getting older, also his kids kept on asking him questions. And he was always like, I can't, you know, it's a big one. I just can't. But he just said, like, the older he gets, the more he gets the feeling, I need to talk about it. And I need to transport my history and not getting it, you know, that it's getting lost.
Well, I'm very, very glad we got to speak to you today. Please keep doing the great work you're doing and keep inspiring so many young people to understand the story of the Holocaust, to understand the personal stories of the people who were there and the people who've been affected by it post the time that it actually occurred. And thank you for coming to South Africa. I'm sorry I didn't get to meet you when you were here, but the exhibition is open and I will go and see it, as will, I'm sure, many more people at the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center, which is in Johannesburg, but it's also going to Cape Town and to Durban. It'll be free to attend in South Africa, so you don't have to pay to get in, and it'll be in Johannesburg until the end of March. So I look forward to seeing many people there and to experiencing all of this. You know, history isn't always fairy tales. In fact, very little of history is fairy tales. Most of it is quite uncomfortable, because you come face to face with the most jarring elements of human nature. And I think that when you convince yourself in your head that all human beings are wonderful and they do great things to each other, you're just telling yourself a horrible lie. At the same time, you don't have to lose all hope in humanity, because the story of the Holocaust is filled, at least at the end of it, with hope. And so many of these survivors will make you feel more hopeful than anyone else. I remember reading Viktor Frankl years ago, and I just thought, you know what? Any problem I have in my life, by comparison with what that man went through, just fades away. And it gives me courage on a daily basis to get through things that aren't really a big deal in the big scheme of things, but maybe, you know, weighing down on me and on that particular day. Once you've read that book, In Search of Meaning, you very quickly realize, like, your problems are nothing. I hope you're going to have a nice time on holiday. I know you're taking a bit of a break, which you well deserve. And come back and visit us in South Africa soon.
Thank you. So thank you very, very much for the great possibility for this wonderful talk. And I can just say, like, you know, have a look at the exhibition, Seeing Auschwitz. And also read Viktor Frankl. And what I just said, I just want to keep Marco Feingold's message up. Just be aware. Don't look away. Be active and be aware.
I love it. Thank you so much. Iris Singer.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com.